I'm an optimist by nature. I think there's a lot of reasons to hope. You know, with COVID, all of us have had to pivot and change the way that we do all kinds of things. I think people will be more nimble and more open to changes because we've had to go through so much upheaval this past year. It's a perfect time to be thinking, how can we reinvent the way that we run our program?
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. In Farm to Table Talk, we talk to people pursuing their dreams and doing something that fulfills them, trying to make a difference. And one of the areas where many people are trying to make a difference is dealing with hunger, not only in the United States, but all over the world. And so I really appreciate having a chance to talk to Katie Martin today, because Katie's in the middle of this and she's going to be sharing what she's learned in a book that's coming out this spring. Katie, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Katie, we're going to get into the book. We're going to get into the issues of the book, but I want to start with, you're the executive director of the Food Share Institute. What is that?
So it's called the Institute for Hunger Research and Solutions, and it's based out of a food bank in Connecticut called Food Share. And we recently merged with the Connecticut Food Bank. So we've got a long name now, Food Share/Connecticut Food Bank. The goal of the Institute is to serve as a resource for other food banks, food pantries, community partners, including academic researchers, to find holistic solutions to the problem of hunger. And we do this in a number of ways. We develop programs to increase access to healthy food. We evaluate programs to identify what works and what doesn't work so well. And we provide trainings and resources so other folks can implement and use these evidence-based programs. And one of our big goals, and this is largely what I talk about in my book, is to create a paradigm shift, to rethink the way that we think about hunger, moving away from a short-term band-aid approach to longer-term, more systemic solutions.
You know, I talk to people that are raising food, and I talk to people that are consuming food, certainly in a lot of, and one thing that strikes me is in the area that you're in, it kind of comes together. I mean, people that are producing food, companies that are producing food, people that want to help feed people, and then people that want to get fed. When you look at the history of food systems in around the country, could you give us a snapshot of where this all started? I mean, at some stage, what do you call them? Were they food banks or food pantries or other programs like this? Where did they originate?
Yep, it's a great question. And it's, I think, really important to understand that history, to know where we've been, to know where maybe we can go and where we should go in the future. So in the U.S., we have a host of federal food assistance programs, the largest of which is the SNAP program, what used to be called food stamps. And we have school lunch and school breakfast programs, the WIC program for women, infants, and children. Many of these programs were developed in the 1960s, 1970s. We have great evidence to show that they work. They help reduce food insecurity. They help improve health outcomes. And in the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, there were some drastic cuts to federal food assistance programs, namely the SNAP program. And many families found themselves having a hard time putting food on the table. Even backing up further, a lot of, when we think of agricultural policies in the 1970s, that changed the way that food is grown and the way that food is produced. The first food bank was started in the late 1960s, and it was a way to tackle food waste and to help people who didn't have enough food. Many of these food banks started a little bit in the 1970s, but it was really in the 1980s with the cuts to the SNAP program, food stamp program, and people recognizing that there were people in communities around the country that didn't have enough food. Very often these were started by faith-based organizations, churches, synagogues, et cetera, that would build food pantries, local-based food pantries. Food banks are the large warehouse-style organizations that help stockpile those foods and distribute to food pantries. And since the 1980s, these food banks and food pantries have grown in number and size, so that we have food pantries in nearly every community around the country. We have food banks that serve every county in the country. And yet, food insecurity and hunger are still pervasive public health problems affecting millions of Americans.
In every county in the country, there's a program like this?
Yeah. So if you search on the Feeding America website, you can put in your zip code or your town and you can find the food bank that represents your local area. So there are food banks that help provide food in every county in the country. And Feeding America is the national umbrella organization that helps to source food and build relationships with food donors. For 200 food banks and Food Share and Connecticut Food Bank that I'm affiliated with, we are members of Feeding America. There are also about 150 or 200 additional food banks that are not affiliated with Feeding America that also help to collect and distribute food. So it's when you talk about food systems, typically we think about grocery stores, school meals, farmers markets, community gardens as being part of our food system, and local farms, of course. Very often people overlook the role that food pantries and food banks play in this national food system of ours, that there are millions of Americans who rely on a local food pantry chronically. Not just once a year, but very often once a week, once or twice a month for their groceries.
Now, when people look at the history of programs like this, of trying to help people that are poor and hungry, many go back and look to the Roosevelt era and the time coming out of the New Deal. And there were many, many programs trying to employ people. And I just assume that food stamps started back then, but they actually started later than that. Is that right?
Well, the pilot program was started shortly after the Great Depression. I believe my history serves maybe 1932-ish. There was a pilot program that was run for a number of years, not very widespread, and it was reintroduced as a formal program during the Kennedy presidency in the 1960s.
Well, and then as these programs grew, sometime, you're talking about the 80s is interesting to me, because within that period of time, there was a lot more attention starting to say, well, wait a minute, maybe we're doing too much. Our taxes are too high. We're wasting a lot of money. So I'm reading between the lines, but what you're saying, it sounds to me like kind of in that period that there was such a cutback that the need became more clear for communities to do their own thing. And again, what I'm hearing you say is that it's one thing to recognize and wring your hands and saying, gee, isn't that a shame because we become stingy or greedy. And on the other hand, people were saying, well, they're wasting money, you know, and people need to help themselves and all that sort of story too. But somehow spontaneously, these programs were just a recognition, apparently, of a need all the way across the country. And they started figuring out, what are we going to do about it? If we're not going to get enough in a government program, how do we as a local community take care of these people that just can't make ends meet and can't put enough on the table to feed their families?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think our charitable food system, and that's the way that I describe food banks and food pantries, it's charitable food, really shows the innate compassion that we Americans have, our ingenuity to say, you know what, there's a need, we need to address it, let's go, let's put this to work. However, it really, you know, it was a turning point in the 1980s, shifting from the strong belief that it's the government's responsibility to provide an adequate social safety net. So when people fall on hard times, there's a safety net to protect you. It really shifted from that long-held belief that that is the government's role to a shift in feeling that this is a charitable response. This is something that local communities, when you think about President Bush the First, the idea of 1,000 points of light, of really encouraging volunteerism, that really we can have people in local communities that help their neighbors. There's a lot of good that comes from that, but it also has morphed into this really taking the government off the hook for providing an adequate social safety net. And it starts to me with livable wages, you know, that if people are putting in time in a job, it should be the minimum by which you can take care of your family and purchase enough groceries and food for your families. And that has eroded since the 1970s.
I want to go back to the point that you were making about how every county has some program like this, because we've gone through a very political year where we've looked at whether you were in a red state or a blue state or a red county or a blue county, or how suburbs feel versus how rural areas feel, and to what extent the government will be help coming up with programs and so forth. But I wonder whether the facts are, that as you're suggesting here, I think, is that there are generous, kind, considerate people everywhere in the country, whether or not they were from a, quote, conservative area or a more liberal area, that they may roll up their sleeves and say, let's do something, no matter whether they were Republican or Democrat or progressives or conservatives. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is there some truth to that?
No, I think you're spot on. And it's important to know also that this charitable food system would absolutely not exist if it weren't for an army of volunteers. So in communities all around the country, there are folks that give of their free time to help provide food, sort food, deliver food, pick up food from grocery stores, deliver it to a local food pantry, sort food in food banks to get it to the local communities. So yes, we are a very compassionate nation, regardless of political background, that really wouldn't exist if it weren't for lots of goodwill throughout the country.
You know, I've done a little bit of this. I'm ashamed I haven't done a whole lot more. Just talking to you, I'm feeling guilty that I haven't done more than I have. But my wife and I have volunteered before, have gone in with a church group, yep, and spent some Saturdays that we were loading boxes up for deliveries to families. And this was like at Second Harvest in Watsonville.
Yep.
And out in California, you've got a broader range of fresh produce, too, yep, that makes it into the mix. And so we're fortunate in that way. But it includes canned goods and other things too. And I think of the team that all comes together, and you're in there working with well, it seemed like in our case, maybe 30 people, you know, that we were, someone was organizing and so forth. You come away from that thinking, that was a great Saturday. You know, I may not remember one that I just went out to brunch or something and took a drive, but being together with everybody in that kind of setting and getting your hands on filling the boxes and with food. And then also in that process, you're also looking at the farms they came from and you're kind of proud of it. You know, you notice these farmers and you notice that they're providing celery and they're providing almonds and they're providing strawberries. And it's a good feeling to see that happening.
Yeah. And I love that you're talking. I mean, your whole podcast is about farm to table, right? And thinking about how and where our food is grown and how do we get that really good locally grown food into many different distribution areas. Thankfully, there has been quite a movement to improving the nutritional quality of charitable food, because historically, most of the charitable food provided was non-perishable. You know, when you think of when this early started, the idea was, well, local food pantries don't have the refrigeration, the capacity, the storage facilities to be able to handle fruits and vegetables and dairy and meats. So it was all canned goods. And when you think about the nutritional quality of canned foods, you know, it's certainly not as ideal as we would like in terms of fresh, wholesome food. That's shifting. And I would encourage folks to really realize it's so possible to distribute fresh, perishable food to food banks, to food pantries. And we know there's demand for it from the people who receive that food. And sometimes it's a matter of building the capacity of local food pantries to make sure they have the storage capacity, the refrigerators. But there certainly is demand. And so making that link between fresh produce, especially if it's locally sourced, into local communities to the people who need it, is really important.
You know, I have to point out real quickly that it's not just California or these areas that are able to produce the fresh, because now we're having greenhouses and we're having rooftop gardens and we're having people that are raising food. In fact, in some abandoned supermarkets back in the Midwest that are being turned into farms. And they don't come up with product that is all, in every case going to be able to go straight to the store or to the restaurants. And so they're producing product too that's fresh, even 12 months a year, yeah, everywhere in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And one program that is really a superstar in this work is the Vermont Food Bank has a Vermont Fresh program, where they have increased the, you know, access to healthy, fresh food. And I figure if you can do it in Vermont, we can really do it anywhere around the country. It's certainly a little bit easier when you're in fertile land like California, but there are many innovative ways that we can get healthy food into communities.
And again, what it comes back to is that supposedly close to 40% of the food that we're producing doesn't make it to somebody's table, let alone to be consumed and digested and everything. And what a waste when we have hungry people. Bringing back to looking at what might be a kind of a quick snapshot of something taking place of, is there such a thing as a typical formation of a community that puts together a food bank or a pantry or like Second Harvest, like I was familiar with? How did these come to be?
Mm-hmm. So many food pantries started in the 1980s in the basements or closets of faith-based organizations, often churches, and they were tended to be relatively small, non-perishable. Food banks started as very community-based, smallish organizations. And the history of them, they continued to outgrow their size. So we would increase the size of the warehouse in the late 1980s, and then about a decade later, do another capital campaign and build a bigger warehouse. However, I'm a fan of the adage that when you've seen one food pantry, you've seen one food pantry. And so while there are similarities to these programs, they really are, it's very different than the school lunch program or the school breakfast program that are very standardized and regulated. They each have their own unique local flair and layout and hours of operation. So I often really encourage folks, if you can, find out who your regional food bank is and go visit them. Take a look. I think you'll be surprised at the scope and scale of the work that they're doing. Go visit a local food pantry. And what I try to do in my book is really outline some best practices and innovative approaches and planting the seeds to encourage people to, you know, evolve and adopt some new ways of thinking in terms of providing charitable food.
You know, when you talk about these systems changing from county to county, that's what I really love about it too, is that it's spontaneous. I mean, you think of programs that are going to be rolled out from the government, from a state government or a national government, certainly like, well, I shouldn't use this example maybe, but like vaccines lately, you know, it varies a great deal. But you think of them being somewhat uniform when they're trying to roll them out across the country. But in fact, that strength that you're mentioning of being able to make each one unique to what's needed in that area, how interesting. And I mean, people get together and identify a need and they're kind of well-intentioned and saying, here's what has to happen here. And I envision, Katie, that either in a church basement or some other group, they get together with a whiteboard and they say, well, we have a problem here, folks. What are we going to do about it? That's where maybe they can come and get your new book.
Right. Well, and one thing I think is important to think about is, you know, mentioned here's a problem in our community and what do we do about it, right? And that's how a lot of this started, that folks in a community would hear that there were people who were laid off or went through a divorce or had a health issue and they were having a hard time getting enough food. And the way we define a problem helps define our solution to that problem. So if we think about the problem of hunger as people don't have enough food, there isn't enough food, then the solution is quite simple. We need to collect and distribute more food. And I would say that's a lot of the history of how we've thought about the problem of hunger and how we have gone about trying to solve the problem of hunger is very much related to food, collecting, distributing more food to more people every year. And we've done a really, really good job of that. But if you think about the problem of hunger instead as being rooted in poverty and systemic injustices that make it harder for certain groups and certain people to access and afford enough food, well, then the solution becomes more complex. And solutions need to be more holistic and more wraparound and addressing other root causes of why people can't afford enough food. Similarly, if we think about the issue of hunger or food insecurity as people don't have enough food, then we can look at it as just providing more. And we need to fill empty bellies, and calories are calories. You know, it's just about getting food because people don't have enough. But if we think about the problem of food insecurity and hunger as linked very strongly to chronic disease risk, that we know the people who are food insecure are at disproportionately high rates of type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension, et cetera, then our solution can really focus not just on pounds of food, but the quality of that food and making sure that if you're providing charitable food that is as nutritious and healthy as possible.
Boy, that opens it up a lot. So on the one hand, if you just say people are hungry, okay, let's all bring the food together and here's the food.
Yep.
But if you go back to the fact that people have other basic issues, that they don't make enough money, that they're not able to keep their kids in childcare and or whatever else while they go get a job someplace else. So are you saying that these entities, these food banks, also take on this broader role of trying to find, help people either, you know, make more money, solve problems, and then the next venture beyond that is the food as medicine issue, and the fact is that the public ends up paying a cost when you have so many people that have obesity and diabetes and other issues that are related to their food habits. That seems pretty ambitious, Katie. That you can, in these counties that in the past just had said, let's get food, let's get people to donate, contribute, and participate, and let's bundle it up and give it to people that are hungry. But so do the same institutions then decide that they're going to talk about why do these people have problems in the first place and say, we're not going to stop with just giving them food, but we're going to help them solve this problem that they don't have enough money or enough knowledge about their diets. And we're going to take that on too?
Yes and yes. increasingly around the country, when I go to conferences and I talk with other food bank staff from around the country, increasingly folks are saying, you know, there must be a better way to do this. Like we've been doing this good work for decades. So the history is important, right? Because we've been doing this charitable food work for over 40 years. And we do a really good job of it. We've become very efficient at providing food and collecting and distributing that food. But when you look at the fact that the problem is still here and it largely mirrors the poverty rate, well then it's time to think about other solutions, and many are. And there are a lot of different approaches for tackling this. So there are some food banks, like the Oregon Food Bank is a clear model that's looking at progressive policies at the state level in terms of living wages and other progressive policies to food pantries and food banks that are involved with healthcare partnerships. So just as you mentioned, how do we link folks that are at high risk for chronic diseases with healthy food? There's some really, we've just conducted an evidence review looking at research of healthcare providers like hospitals and clinics that can screen their patients for food insecurity. And when they screen positive, they can provide vouchers for fruits and vegetables, help enroll them in the SNAP program, help refer them to other food pantry programs, do health promotion. And there's a lot of great innovative work that's happening there too. So part of the message that I give is there are a lot of different approaches that you can take to move beyond just the simple distribution of food. And the most important part is just getting started.
I would think when you're starting to do more, you need to have more either volunteers. You start having to hire people. I mean, you're, part of that problem, it seems, is that to be able to help people deal with these other issues, you need more than volunteer help. And then you have to raise more funds, and you have to get either state agencies or companies to be able to contribute money so that you could have people that work on doing the things that you're discussing. Is that fair?
Yes. And yet we don't have to do it alone. I think it's really important to think about collaborations, partnerships between nonprofit organizations. So food banks partnering with other community agencies that provide affordable childcare, that provide mental health services, that provide access to affordable transportation, job training. As a food bank or a food pantry, you don't necessarily have to recreate that wheel. There are very likely other community agencies that are offering those types of services. How can you partner together to do those more holistically? And then partnerships with other government agencies, for sure. How do we help make sure that the people who are coming for charitable food are taking advantage of other federal food assistance programs like SNAP and WIC, school breakfast, school meals? And then let's not forget corporations and businesses, partnering with them to make sure that people can take advantage of other, you know, job incubation programs and second chance employers that can help folks that need to get back into the workforce.
I'm wondering where this connects politically. We have a new administration in Washington. We have new chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, and they deal with some programs like this, not only within the Farm Bill, but they have other programs that are going on. And certainly across the country, there's state programs as well. Yeah. So where do the people that you work with, or even your organization, where do you interact with the political agendas that mm-hmm. could be able to help?
Well, I'm certainly really encouraged by our new Biden administration. You know, first and foremost, they're talking about food insecurity. They're, you know, putting these issues front and center, recognizing that this is a problem in the United States. And the federal food assistance programs are the first line of defense against hunger. So many, many food banks, the majority of food banks around the country, provide outreach for SNAP. So helping enroll people in the SNAP program. I think that used to be considered outside of the parameters of what a food bank would do. That was seen as maybe too political, or seen as stepping outside of the mission of a food bank. But when we realize that when people who are eligible for SNAP, when they enroll in SNAP, there's so much of a bigger bang for the buck, for the amount of money that's provided through SNAP is way more than the food that you can receive at a local food pantry. And those food dollars feed right back into the local economy. So it helps the local economy. So I think that is certainly an area that most food banks, regardless of political background, have engaged in. I think when we talk about the root causes of food insecurity, as I mentioned, when we think about these as not just about food, but rooted in poverty, the fact that the Biden administration is talking about increasing the minimum wage, that's a surefire way to reduce hunger in America. If people, when you work and get paid for that work in a livable wage, then people can go and shop for their food with dignity at the grocery store and not have to rely on other charitable programs. So I think there are still a lot of food banks that would say that is too political. We don't want to go there. We don't want to turn off our donors. But if we really are serious about ending hunger in our communities, these are the kinds of approaches that we need to be talking about.
But that also leads to another problem. And that is that all the counties have different situations, which is one of the strengths of what's been done up to now. And even when you talk about minimum wage, if it did go to $15 and it's $7.25 in Mississippi and some of the southern states and some others right now, but in California, it's already scheduled to be $14 without a federal law. So there's a huge, huge difference from one state to the next. So that's going to require that flexibility and ingenuity, because every state's going to be different, you know, even though they're trying to address this with a across the board federal change.
Right.
So they can buy your book. And why did you write this book?
So I'm obviously very passionate about this issue of hunger. And I spent a lot of time visiting food pantries and food banks around the country, seeing some really innovative superstar programs, and also seeing programs recently that look like they were straight out of 1982. And by that, I mean the mentality of just providing food for today, less focus on nutritious, healthy food. And in my book, I'm fairly critical of the charitable food system. And I argue for change. And I challenge the status quo. But obviously, I wouldn't be working at a food bank if I didn't believe in this work. And one of the themes of the book is that we're doing good work, but we can do better. And the goal of my book is bold yet simple. It is to reinvent the way that we provide charitable food in our country and moving away from short-term transactions of food to longer-term transformations of lives. So we will likely always have some degree of hunger in our country, but not to the scope and scale that we have right now. There are millions of Americans that are food insecure that don't want to rely on charity. They want justice. They want to be able to make a livable wage. They want to be able to provide for their families. They want to be able to buy fresh, healthy food to nourish their families. All of us should have access to that.
And when you do these kind of programs, is there a way that pull local farmers in? And one of the reasons I'm asking that too is that there is food that is provided by, say, USDA, you know, bulk commodities that they purchase. And if USDA is going to be purchasing some of these bulk commodities that are helping a commodity market and distributing them, some have said, why can't they purchase local fresh foods? And then the farmer, in addition to donating what they can, but the farmer can actually be able to sell some to an agency that is then providing them. So that the farmer is into a system, again, that keeps local food to be more distributed locally as well, but also possibly have some compensation too.
Right. It's similar in many ways when you think about some states have put in language that for school meal programs that a certain percent must be locally sourced, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly this year during COVID, there has been more government commodity food available to food banks and to distribute through food pantries. You're right, they could put in waivers such that a certain percentage is locally sourced to really reinforce that locally grown nature. There are examples, particularly in the food is medicine, food bank healthcare partnership models, where there's an emphasis on helping connect patients who are food insecure with vouchers for farmers markets, vouchers for food distribution programs. Some food banks have partnered with local farmers and with healthcare providers to make that full circle, right? So making sure that the farmers are able to distribute their food and getting it into the hands of those who need it, who are most vulnerable and disadvantaged, and make sure that they have access.
Well, it won't be long before people will get some of those questions answered though, because they'll get to get your book.
Really should, yeah. So you can go on Amazon, Reinventing Food Banks and Pantries. It's published by Island Press. So if you go on their website, you can put in my last name, Martin, and get 20% off. So that's a nice little treat for your listeners.
Should they have to say Farm to Table Talk or just put in
Martin? Just put in Martin.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The access code for Island Press.
Listeners that have stayed with us this long in this interesting conversation are interested in helping others. They're either in a program, or I think we could twist their arms a little bit and say there's a way for them to get involved and a way that for them to help, and there's certainly reasons that they should care. I have to ask you just one more follow-up question. You see where you are with a journey. You've gone back and you see where we were in the 80s and when there was the need to come together and adjusting to the issues that we're facing today. So if you look at this next period of time, if you look at the next 5 years, what gives you reason to be hopeful or optimistic about this next stage of the journey?
Oh, well, I'm an optimist by nature, but I think there's a lot of reasons to hope. For one, for many of these programs that have been operating for years, often decades, you know, with COVID, all of us have had to pivot and change the way that we do all kinds of things because of this pandemic. So we can no longer say, you know what, this is how we've always done things. So I think many, many programs who have been questioning the way they do things have been looking for a different approach. I think people will be more nimble and more open to changes because we've had to go through so much upheaval this past year, particularly for local food pantries who've had to really change the way that they're providing food. We've had to have social distancing, having to do drive-through, no-touch types of food distributions. I think many of us are, you know, really, well, we're all hopeful for the other end of COVID, but it's a perfect time to be thinking, how can we reinvent the way that we run our program? And my hope is that the timing of this book is going to be just right as people are thinking, okay, we're going to be able to move back indoors and be able to have people shop for their food at our pantry. What might that look like? And how might we do things differently than we have before? One easy example is a best practice within food pantries is what's called client choice, where people get to choose their food like they would at a grocery store. And we know that this is a better way to allow people to pick out charitable food. But before COVID, this was not common practice. I would say it varies food pantry to food pantry, but probably less than 50% of food pantries around the country would allow their clients to choose their own food. If you just think about the nature of that, what that would feel like to go get food when it's handed to you, you don't have the choice. With COVID, obviously, with public health measures in place, we had to shift back to the more traditional model of volunteers bagging it up, boxing it up, and having no touch. My hope is that coming out of COVID, more and more food pantries who maybe were considering thinking about client choice, why not redefine what that can look like and reshape the nature of your food pantry?
I hope you're right. And I think there's got to be some good come from all of these lessons we're learning on how to be innovative and try new approaches. And I really appreciate what you're doing, Katie Martin, and wish you the best with the book. But all the people that are following you and following what's going on and making a difference in the local communities, they're so, so important. And I'm really glad you took the time to share that with us on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.